You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, we're going to just hear in a moment an excerpt from one of the most amazing, astounding displays of ingratitude in the entire biblical record. This is a story from Exodus that takes place about 6 weeks into what turns out to be a 40-year stint in the desert. Okay, and I just want you to think about this. They have just 6 weeks ago walked through the parted Dead Sea. You think that would still be on their mind? Evidently not. They've just been protected from the Egyptian chariots and army by a towering pillar of fire. You'd think that might still be emblazoned on their memories, right? Evidently not. They're 6 weeks into it, and the complaints are beginning. First off, as often happens with leadership, the very first thing that is blamed is that Aaron and Moses are trying to kill us. That's the first, I mean, they just go from 0 to 60 like that, right? Clearly you have brought us out here to die, right? Is that your point? That's the number one thing that they think. The number two thing is that they would, you know, essentially given what they're having to experience here in the desert, they would actually rather go back to slavery, right? I mean, and the issue is in the Numbers passage, which we're not hearing this morning, the story is told twice. And there are a lot of differences in the details. But I love how in the Numbers version of the story, the thing that they are most upset about, the things that they miss the most, are onions and leeks. As you do, right? If you don't have onions and leeks, you might as well just hang it up. And that's basically what they're saying. You brought us out here in the desert. There are no onions and no leeks. Are you trying to kill us? Right? That is exactly what is going on in this story. Completely forgetting all of the things that have just transpired, you know, back, you know, at the end of October, right? That's how long ago. I can't remember the end of October, actually. So, but you can see that this is kind of a crazy thing. So we're going to hear just an excerpt from this passage in Exodus, but I think you'll kind of get the flavor for God is just kind of like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with these people? The ingratitude is killing me. So let's hear this story from Exodus.
The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way I will test them, whether they will follow my instruction or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on the other days." So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your complaining against the Lord. For what are we that you complain against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening, and your fill of bread in the morning, because the Lord has heard the complaining that you utter against him, what are we? Your complaining is not against us, but against the Lord." In the evening quails came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a fine, flaky substance, as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, for these stories that come down to us from so long ago, we're grateful. And as we consider them for our lives, may the Spirit be at work in our minds and in our hearts so that none of us would leave this place unchanged. We gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. Oh, once upon a time, a couple of friends ran into one another on the street, and one looked at the other, and he was almost on the verge of tears. And the man said, "Hey, my friend, what is going on with you? You look like your whole world has caved in." And the sad guy says, let me tell you, 3 weeks ago, an uncle of mine died and left me $50,000. And his friend said, "Well, that's not bad at all." And the guy said, "Hold on, I'm just getting started. 2 weeks ago, a cousin who I'd never met died and left me $95,000, tax-free to boot." And his friend's thinking, "Well, that's great. I mean, I'd like that." And then the guy said, "But wait, last week, my grandfather passed away, and I inherited almost $1 million. And his friend's like, "Well, why so sad?" And the guy said, "This week, nothing." Now, look, I would say that it began again this weekend, but I think it's actually beginning earlier and earlier. And you know what I'm talking about? Retail Christmas, right? Christmas decorations are up now before Halloween. Black Friday has slopped over into Thanksgiving. The annual rush for more has begun. More for less. More than them. All fueled by the notion that more somehow means happiness. More means better. That more means contentment. It's a challenge because our whole society, our whole consumer culture depends essentially on advertisers and others creating dissatisfaction. And in the process, it robs us of one of the more elusive states of the spiritual life, which is contentment. It's fleeting. It's hard to get there and stay there. Sometimes it seems like whatever season of life that we're in, the message is, I will be more content when I finally have fill in the blank, right? Wherever we're at, there's always something more. For kids this time of year, it's a particular toy or video game. For us adults, it might be a particular life experience. But it is all a part of our kind of primal urge to hoard, right? Just in case. We don't want to be without. So, you know, we gotta have this, we gotta have that, just in case. In fact, not being content actually has an upside, because it was probably one of the things that kept our hunter-gatherer ancestors alive long enough for them to become our ancestors, right? So that's good. But today, we live in a different world. We live in a culture where most of our basic needs are most of the time met. The rest is mostly just a matter of degree, right? And we want what we want. And when do we want it? Yeah. Now. And that's just built in. That's trained into us. So it shouldn't be surprising when we look at our story today. First off, let me just once again reiterate, this is a story. Don't get that wrong. It's a story told by a storyteller. There's absolutely no archaeological evidence. There's no historical evidence that there were ever Hebrew slaves in Egypt. Full stop, period. Are you with me? No evidence whatsoever. What we need to keep in mind is that this is a story that was made up by a storyteller who clearly had never been where they're talking about, and used elements of the story that if you'd been there, you go, oh, this can't be right. My Hebrew scripture professor, Harold Beck, said, you know, think about this. The entire area on the Sinai Peninsula where the Israelites were lost for 40 years is smaller than the state of West Virginia. Okay, are you with me? And Harold said he's been on the top of Mount Sinai where when you're up there, you can look and you can see the Mediterranean, you can see the Red Sea, you can see, you can see a long way. And he said, if you're lost in this part of the world for 40 years, you deserve to be lost, right? I mean, there's something wrong that you can't, you know, find your way, okay? So keep that in mind. And the story is told, I think, not to keep a historical record, but it's primarily an object lesson about contentment and about trusting. And as soon as you see that, then you can sit back and enjoy the story. You don't have to start figuring out what manna is, right? And I have endured people trying to figure out what manna is. Nobody quite knows what manna is because manna is in the same category as the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, right? And if you go looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, what does that say about you, okay? People have tried so hard to say, oh, manna is, you know, it's the sap that oozes out of a particular tamarisk tree at a particular time of year. Oh, please. Or, you know, they try to figure out a way and they're missing the point. If you try to explain it, you're missing the humor in it as well. Manna is not greeted with universal joy. In the Hebrew, you know, when they say, what is this? It's preceded by, oi, what's this? You know, what is this stuff we have to scrape off the ground? You know, they don't know what it is. And in the Numbers version, they jump straight ahead to, hey, we ask for onions. We ask for leeks. And this is what we get? Please. I choose slavery. Thank you. I'd rather go back. So when the Israelites first saw the manna, they were not impressed. What we know is that this bread was designed, more than anything, to test how well the Israelites could learn to follow instructions, to obey God. Manna is the ultimate in perishable food, right? The people were to gather only enough for one day, no more, no less. And on that sixth day, whatever they gathered would last them through the Sabbath, right? When they weren't supposed to work. If they tried to save any overnight, you know, if they tried to squirrel some away, it would go bad. It would get wormy. There is no amount of pre-planning, no amount of hoarding, no amount of storage on their part that would help. The point is one day at a time. The point is this present moment. That's it. That's what you're supposed to focus on. It's a trust issue, and it's one that the Hebrews struggle with over and over in this story. It's like, I don't know if you know this syndrome. It's in the DMS-5 or DSM-5. It's the poor college student at the wedding reception or the all-you-can-eat buffet phenomena, right? And you've seen it. I'm not saying that I have ever done this before, but it's where you get your plate and you fill it to a huge heaping amount, more than anybody could imagine, because you're not sure when your next meal is going to come. Right? So you've got to get what you can when you can. So today's object lesson, though, is for the Israelites to learn to trust, to take it one day at a time and to deal with what they've got right in front of them and be grateful and content with just that. Well, this is not the only reason, but they obviously weren't very good at it, because to get it right, to finally get to a place where God thought, okay, they're getting it, it took 40 years, right? Can you be that bad? I don't know. Maybe you can. I don't think we're too far beyond Thanksgiving yet. Is it okay to quote a Puritan, right? Here we go. Here's what a Puritan had to say. Contentment is a sweet inward heart thing. It is a work of the Spirit indoors. It is a box of precious ointment, very comforting and useful for troubled hearts in times of troubled conditions. Isn't that beautiful? It's just visceral, isn't it? Contentment is like an ointment. It's an inward, sweet inward heart thing. It's beautiful. But our troubled hearts live in a culture that gins up troubled conditions, doesn't it? It seems like you can't turn around without more and more trouble. And the whole thing tries to convince us that material possessions or outward recognition of or fulfillment of our exact expectations is the only way to feel a sense of satisfaction. Contentment is then inevitably short-lived. Done like that. There will always be someone. There will always be something else that is better or is more desirable than what we have, leading to feelings of dissatisfaction. So, because of the world that we live in, contentment can be as foggy, fleeting, and frustrating as a dream. Mainly, I'm guessing, the main reason contentment is so slippery is because you people don't know where contentment comes from, do you? You don't know where it comes from at all. Do you know where they make contentment? They make it in the satisfactory. Satisfactory? You might get that later. Okay. I knew I could work that in someday. Many, many years ago, one of my spiritual directors, Bill Martin, told me a story that has stuck with me and has really shaped my understanding of this whole idea of contentment. And it goes back to the kind of mystical Jewish teachings of the Kabbalah, of the Midrash, the stories that go along with the canon that we have in the Bible, but are kind of on the periphery, in the margins. And just as a little bit of background, that ancient understanding of God, of Yahweh, was that God was not alone in the heavens. God had a heavenly court, a royal court, like a Middle Eastern potentate, right? And the members of the court all had different roles. One of those people, one of those beings in the heavenly court was kind of like the celestial district attorney. And it's where we get the term the devil's advocate, right? Because this being was called Ha-Satan. Ha is the definite article in Hebrew, and Satan is the challenger. So Ha-Satan, the challenger, right? We've dropped the definite article, capitalized the S, and called him Satan, right? But this is a character in Yahweh's royal court. And so one day, after creation was all complete, God came into the royal court and was dusting off God's coveralls and going, whew, boy, that was good. Creation is beautiful, isn't it, everybody? Look at it. It's wonderful. Look at all these beautiful fjords and desert islands and whatever else. But you know what I'm most proud of? What I'm most proud of is these human beings. I mean, take a look at them. Aren't they wonderful? You know, one of the most wonderful things about them is they love me. They love me. Just look at them. They love me. And Ha-Satan says, well, why wouldn't they love you? I mean, you've given them everything. You've given them all this wonderful world to live in. You've given them all these things. And he said, it's really not fair. It's really not a good measure of how much they love you if all you do is bless them. I mean, you got to curse them as well, because that would be a good measure. If they were equally cursed as they were blessed, then I might be impressed that they actually love you. And God thought about that for a little bit, and he said, well, you know what? I have blessed them. I've blessed them with the ability, unlike any other animal, to look into the future and dream dreams and see visions of what might be, so that they can work towards things that haven't existed yet. And I've also blessed them to give them the power to look back in the past and think about all the wonderful things that they experience and hold on to memories that are beautiful and to make their life rich in experiences that they can remember. And Hasatan says, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Those are great blessings. You got to curse them as well. And God said, I have. Because with that power to look into the future and see visions of the future, you also have anxiety and worry about what might happen and fret about them. And with the power to look back into the past and have memories, you also have regrets. You have disappointments about what you haven't accomplished and what will never be. I have cursed them. And that is one of those stories that helped me to understand that you really cannot experience contentment. You really cannot be satisfied in the future because we're not there yet. And you cannot be content in the past because that's done. You can only be content. You can only be at peace. You can only experience life in this moment, here and now, full stop. That's it. And as soon as you start thinking about the future and being anxious about that, as soon as you start thinking about the past and being regretful about that, contentment evaporates. Contentment is not in worry about the future or regret about the past. It's about an awareness of the simple blessings in life here and now. How hard is that, right? As soon as we try to start thinking about being right here and now, it's always about something else trying to break in. Think about those moments, those gorgeous moments, when a beautiful sunrise catches your attention. That hummingbird is flitting right outside your window. The gurgling of a baby that you're holding in your arms. The sound of the ocean as you walk along a beach. The cool breeze in the desert on an otherwise hot day. My favorite, just this last week, was the smell of greasewood after a rain. Oh, there is not a lot better than that. Imagine how alive we could be if we could discipline ourselves to be aware of the moment that we're living in. We get into trouble as soon as we tie our contentment to a particular plan. Let's call it plan A, shall we? Plan A is something that we want to have in our lives, that we've envisioned in our lives. And you know what your plan A is, whether you have articulated it or not. We have all internalized plan A's all over the place. Plan A is to have a warm, delightful family night next week. But sometimes life requires acceptance of plan B when that warm family night breaks down into an argument that crashes your otherwise plan A family night. Maybe you have to go to plan C when Aunt Wanda loses her temper. We all have to bear with plan A not working out. We all crave plan A. But more often than not, real life means adapting to plan B. Few people would have plan A in their lives of having a child with severe learning disabilities. No one desires regularly ruined plans because of bouts with migraine headaches. No one's plan A includes a satisfying job that suddenly disintegrates or long-term relationships that sour. Like the Israelites in the desert, it's easy to become bitter and complain when our hopes and expectations are not met. But guess what? This story is about knowing when to move to plan B. The Israelites didn't just sit down and say, manna, right? Did you hear the story? They're not happy about it. They were moving, though, from slavery to freedom. And while manna was not their plan A, leeks and onions were plan A, thank you very much. Manna was a solid plan B. It was a solid plan B. And it kept them alive in the desert to get them, where were they going? The promised land. Like nowhere any of them had ever imagined before. But they only got there because of plan B. Now, this is not, of all the spiritual disciplines that I've been talking about for the last few months, this one kind of sounds like the spiritual discipline of lowered expectations, right? That's not what this is. That's not what this is all at all. This is about heightening our expectation of here and now, right? Contentment helps us to see the present more clearly, and it frees us from the anxiety about the future or regret about the past so that we can get to a place that we couldn't even have imagined when we were in Egypt. Which takes us to our stream of thought for today. Contentment is not in the future. It's not in the past. It's when?
Here
and now. That's the only place it can be. Is here and now. Once upon a time, Nasruddin was having a vivid dream. He was deeply asleep, and he had a vision of a disembodied hand coming in and carefully placing large, glistening gold coins directly into his purse. One, clink, two, clink, three, clink. Oh, Nasruddin was counting just gleefully in his dream. Four, clink, five, clink, six, clink. He just couldn't believe his good fortune. Got up to eight, clink, nine, clink. And suddenly the hand stopped and started to move away. And Nasruddin exclaimed, "What?" And jumped up and started wrangling that disembodied hand, screaming, "I must have 10! I must have 10! I told you I must have 10! And he was so animated in his wrestling with this disembodied hand in his dream that he woke himself up. And suddenly he realized, oh my gosh. So he immediately laid back down and closed his eye and said, "Okay, 9. We have truly been blessed. We can dream of a future that has not been. We can see visions of what yet might be. We can remember with joy profound moments and comforts in our past. But we've been cursed as well, because those powers we can use against ourselves, and we need to be present to this moment. The antidote to anxiety, to regret, and dissatisfaction is right here. It's right now. It's in the awareness of the presentness of the mystery of the divine, the gift of life and the richness of this moment. I have to say, I've adopted something at my holiday dinners that I got from Angela Swetnam. And I use it every time. People are like, are we going to do an Angela again? Yes. Right. You say it at your house too? Which is basically when we're standing around the table about to eat, when we're standing around, I ask, and I think I get this right, I ask everybody to just look around. Look around at this gathering of people who are our resources in life, who are the people that, as difficult as sometimes we are with one another, that we can depend on, that are blessings in our lives. And that is something to be grateful for. When? Here and now. So I want you to just look around. Look around this room. Go ahead, you can turn. Look around at these people. We are here for one another. And as for me, I'm grateful. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.